Well, this morning I want to start with a top 10 list. A top 10 list. Here are the top 10 statements Noah uttered aboard the ark. Number 10, strange. We haven't seen another boat for weeks. Number 9, if I'd only brought more rhino litter. Number 8, for the rest of my life, I never want to sleep on a waterbed again. 7, does anyone have more Dramamine? 6, fish for supper again? Number 5, what? You can't find your phone to take a photo of that rainbow? 4, honey, would you stop saying, into each life a little rain must fall? Number 3, how can I fish with just 2 worms? Number 2, God, are you sure I don't need to keep the termites in a tin can? I would have thought that. And then number 1, as Noah exited the ark, he slapped his neck and he mumbled, I should have killed those lousy mosquitoes while I had the chance. In the first 6 chapters of Genesis, God goes from good to grieved. After his creation, God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good. But by chapter 6, the world was so wicked that God was grieved that he had made man. And the only way to save humanity was to destroy the earth and to start over. A deliverer was needed. And God said, I know a guy. I know a guy. Genesis 6 verse 8 tells us, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. God told Noah to build a box, an ark, and then gather his wife, his 3 sons, their wives, and 2 of every kind of animal on the earth. And Noah obeyed. Which is where we pick up the story this morning in chapter 7 verse 1. Then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. What a scene here. When it's time to board the ark, God doesn't tell Noah to go into the ark, but to come into the ark. Implied is that God is already on board, waiting for Noah and his family to join him. We call this Noah's Ark, but never, never doubt that God is the captain of this vessel. Actually, we've referred to the Ark as a boat, but technically it was not. It was a barge. It was a large barge. It had no onboard navigation. Noah didn't steer the Ark. It was up to God to guide it and to dock the Ark at its proper resting place. And the next time you feel like you've lost control of your life and can't navigate the storm you're in, please remember who's on board. You need to trust Captain Jesus to steer your ship. Well, verse 2, God continues his instructions to Noah. You shall take with you 7 each of every clean animal, a male and his female. 2 each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also 7 each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. Now throughout Genesis, there is a 6+1 pattern. God creates the world in 6 days, and then he rests on day 7. When it comes to the clean animals, 3 pairs were taken to mate. And 1 was to be a sacrifice to God. Thus, Noah takes 6+1, 3 pairs and a spare. Of the unclean variety, there were just 1 pair, a male and a female. Now, the distinctions clean and unclean will later be spelled out and codified in the law of Moses, but apparently they were also known at the time of Noah. Verse 4, for after 7 more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. A week elapses from the time Noah boards to the time it starts to rain. Now, we don't really know how long it took Noah to build the ark, God's countdown in chapter 6, verse 3 was 120 years. But we know that as Noah was building, he was also preaching. For 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5 calls him a preacher of righteousness. And yet no one believed his sermon. No one responded. And imagine now the ridicule hurled at Noah from outside the ark. One of my favorite Bible expositors, Alexander McLaren, he writes this: "For 120 years, the wits laughed, and the common sense people wondered, and the patient saint went on hammering and pitching at his ark. But one day it began to rain, and by degrees, somehow, Noah did not seem quite such a fool. The jest would look different when the water was up to the knees of the jesters, and their sarcasms would stick in their throats as they drowned. So it is always. So it will be at the last great day when people awake too late to the conviction that they are outside the ark of safety." Well, Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the floodwaters were on the earth. So Noah with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters of the flood, of clean animals, of animals that are unclean, of birds, and of everything that creeps on the earth. Two by two, they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. Now remember, Noah's ark measured 450 feet long by 75 feet wide by 45 feet high. Its three floors provided 101,250 square feet of floor space, or 1,518,750 cubic feet. To illustrate its capacity, you're looking at the equivalent payload of a train pulling 522 boxcars, each packed with 240 sheep. That would be a total of 125,280 sheep could fit aboard the ark. Now, the Ryrie Study Bible, it estimates that there are approximately 17,600 species of animals on the earth today. And understand, Noah didn't have to take 17,600 species. He could have simply taken the kinds, the larger groupings, and the interbreeding would have eventually produced the variety of animals that exist today. But let's say he did take 17,600 species. Now, given that some of the animals are larger than sheep, and other animals are smaller than sheep, I mean, we could just use sheep as the average size animal. Thus, two of every unclean and seven of the clean would equal about 40,000 sheep. That's not a bad estimate. And since the ark could hold 125,280 sheep, 40,000 sheep would take up just 28% of the ark's capacity. That would be leaving plenty of room for food and supplies and Noah and his family. They could even stretch out. Verse 10. "And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the deep, the great deep, were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights." Now here the Bible gives us an excellent description of flood mechanics. Notice verse 11. "The windows of heaven were open." Literally, the sluice gates were unleashed. See, this was not just 40 days of simple rain. This was a gushing collapse of a suspended ocean. The vapor canopy that had been shrouding the earth now collapses. In addition, the fountains of the great deep were broken up. Volcanic explosions release pockets of underground water and aquifers. Subterranean springs and oceans burst from underneath the crust of the earth. Water comes from above and water rises from below. Some scholars believe that God initiated the flood with a comet or a meteorite that penetrated the vapor canopy surrounding the pre-flood planet. The cosmic collision caused its collapse, and such an impact would have also caused the Earth's axis to tilt. The single global landmass would then split into multiple continents, and it would cause massive mountains to rise. In other words, the flood altered the whole geology of planet Earth. As 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 6 puts it, the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. So that when Noah and his family eventually exit the ark, they walk out into a whole new physical environment. And let me suggest that a global flood is a far better explanation for the Earth's geology than is evolution. Evolutionists suggest that the planet's topography and strata were formed by natural processes over long periods of time. I'm so sorry, but I have been to the Grand Canyon, and I have seen all its varied geological formations. I just can't believe it was cut out by the little trickle called the Colorado River. To say that canyon started as a small gully, well, I'm just not that gullible. You see, creation scientists have done research on Mount St. Helens and have documented how many geological structures thought to have formed over millions of years occurred instantly in 1981 as a result of the volcanic eruption. Cataclysm is what creates fossils. And think about fossils. Our Earth is a giant burial ground. And yet what makes a fossil? Natural processes? Of course not. I mean, when a fish falls to the ocean floor and dies, it doesn't turn into a fossil. It gets eaten by scavengers or it just deteriorates. No, it takes pressure and compaction and instant burial for a fossil to form, conditions that would be present in a flood. Even the placement of the fossils in the Earth's strata are better explained by their ability to survive in the surge of the floodwaters. The animal's body type, its mobility, its density, its habitat all explain how high the animal could propel itself upwards in the flooding before it was overcome and compacted in the sediment. Well, verse 3 continues, on the very same day, Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, all cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after its kind, every bird of every sort. And they went into the ark to Noah, two by two, of all flesh in which is the breath of life. So those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. Notice that. The Lord himself closes the door of the ark, shuts the passengers in. God is overseeing their safety. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. For in the scriptures, the number 40 is the number of God's judgment. The waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth, and the ark moved about on the surface of the waters, and the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. Notice this was a global flood, for all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. See, if it had been a regional flood, why build an ark? Just move the family to higher ground. Hey, it's not just the Bible, but numerous ancient histories attest to a worldwide flood. Did you know that over 200 cultures have a story similar to Noah? 88% mention a favored family. 70% tell us that the family survived in a boat. He goes on in verse 20 and says, the waters prevailed 15 cubits upwards, and the mountains were covered. Now, the water level was 15 cubits. That's 22 and a half feet above the tallest peak. It could be that prior to the flood, the earth's surface was fairly level, except for a few high hills. Mountain ranges formed as a result of the torrential runoffs and the massive erosion that occurred post-flood. The receding waters is what shaped the earth's geology and topography. And all flesh died that moved on the earth. Birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. Devastating. Fish didn't die because water is their habitat. And so God destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Notice it didn't matter how good a swimmer you were. Did you know that every Olympic swimmer died in the flood? Every one of them. Why? Human effort, human ingenuity saved no one. The only people saved were those who trusted in God's provision. And the same is true of our salvation today. Friend, depend on your own merit, your own abilities, your own goodness. You'll drown. Only the people who humble themselves and trust in Jesus will be saved. Actually, the ark is a beautiful picture of our Lord Jesus. It was a trinity, three decks, but one ark. God was in the ark, and he was also in Jesus. Both Noah and Jesus were carpenters who built a judgment-proof salvation. When Noah entered the ark, he left behind his old life, and he received a new life. The same occurs for those who put their faith in Jesus. And there was only one ark, just as there is only one salvation today. Genesis chapter 6, verse 16 tells us that the ark had a single door. And that door was in its side. And it was out of that door that Noah came to repopulate the earth. Likewise, it's from Jesus' side, his wounded side, that his life-giving blood populates heaven. And lastly, it's interesting, the ark landed on Mount Ararat on the Hebrew date, Nisan the 17th, which is no coincidence, for that is the exact day of the year that Jesus rose from the dead, Nisan the 17th. Both events mark the new beginnings for mankind. Well, chapter 8 begins. Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. They began to recede. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. The ark drifted for 5 months, then rested on Mount Ararat. Today, Ararat is a 16,254-foot peak in northeast Turkey. It's near the border of Turkey, Iran, and Armenia. In fact, the November 1st, 2023 edition of Popular Mechanics magazine featured an article entitled, "Archaeologists Believe They Might Have Found the Real Noah's Ark." It's interesting. Sadly, they didn't. They found evidence of human activity at the location and around the time the ark had landed, but no ark. You know, it seems that whenever a heat wave melts the snow and ice on Ararat, search parties set out to find the ark. And over the centuries, there have been many contested claims of sightings and of wood samples, but again, no ark. Either God is preserving the ark as a testimony in the last days, or the ark became firewood and shelters for those that had survived the flood. Well, verse 5 tells us, "And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month." In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. 2.5 months after the ark grounded on Ararat, the water level had receded to reveal some of the surrounding summits. And so it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Oh, what a relief that was. That cannot be underestimated. He opened that window, man. Fresh air for a stuffy, stinky ark. Can you imagine? That was a big day for Mrs. Noah. And then he sent out a raven, which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the face of the ground. Now, a raven is a scavenger. If it finds a drifting carcass, it'll just feed off its flesh and never return. But a dove lands on dry ground. And it was the habits of these two birds. These became Noah's means of checking out how far the waters had receded on the earth. Verse 9. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned into the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and drew her into the ark to himself. And he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent the dove out from the ark. Then the dove came to him in the evening, and behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth. And no one knew that the waters had receded from the earth. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him anymore. Notice, every 7 days, Noah releases a dove. I personally think this was a ritual. This was a part of Noah's worship. See, each Sabbath, it might have been the Sabbath, every 7 days. Each Sabbath, he sent out the dove. Why? As an act of faith. He trusted that the waters were receding, that the earth would begin anew. And notice how Noah moves forward here in all this. I think it's a good model for us. He gains all the information he can. He sends out the raven. He sends out the dove. He's gaining information while at the same time he waits on God to give the final word to exit the ark. He combines both common sense and divine revelation. That's a good way to go forward. Verse 13. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. Imagine Noah's first inspection of a post-flood world. He saw blue skies, he saw clouds, things he might not have been able to see before. The vapor canopy that had been protecting the earth from the sun is now gone. As a result, men will no longer live 900 years. Lifespans quickly are reduced to today's ages. Rather than pre-flood tropics, earth now is colder. It will soon plunge into an ice age. After 11 months in isolation, Noah walks onto the deck of the ark to survey a very, very different world. A month later, in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you." Now, the same God who said, "Come in," now says, "Go out." And this is the case with us. God calls us to come to Christ. He is our ark. We come in, but after we're saved, after we're grown, after we've matured, he instructs us to go out and to be fruitful. It's interesting that Noah entered the ark on the 10th day of the second month. He exited on the 27th day of the same month, 1 year later. Noah was in the ark for 377 days, over a year. It's a long time, especially before he opened that window. And 60% of the time was spent sitting in the same place, waiting on the waters to recede. You think Noah had to learn patience? I bet he did. He had to wait on God. I like the great Puritan pastor, Phillips Brooks. He was pacing back and forth in his living room one day when a friend came to visit. He asked Brooks, he said, why he was so restless. Phillips replied, because I am in a hurry and God is not. We too need to learn to rest in God's promises, to allow God to bring them to pass in His time and in His way. Remember the name Noah. It means rest. Well, verse 17. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every animal, every creeping thing, every bird, and whatever creeps on the earth according to their families went out of the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Noah's first act when he steps off the ark onto dry ground is to build an altar, to offer a sacrifice, and to worship his God. You know, it was man's sin that destroyed God's world, but the flood didn't destroy sin. And thus, Noah's first step is to offer a sacrifice for his own sin. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. In other words, God was pleased with Noah's sacrifice. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. Natural rhythms, the seasons of the year will not be interrupted again. Even though the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, God won't judge us again, not until the end of the age. He'll judge one last time, but not with the flood, but with the fire. Now in chapter 9, God makes a covenant with Noah suited for a post-flood world. So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now that's important. Fill the earth. And the fruit of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. In other words, you can eat the meat, but you shouldn't cook it too rare. Some of you guys that go real rare, I worry about you. Prior to the flood, humans were vegetarians. But afterward, God added meat to our diet. He blessed us with Big Macs and barbecue and bacon. Evidently, post-flood people needed an extra source of protein. And now that animals become that source, God instills within the animal kingdom an instinctual fear of human beings. Notice verse 2 calls it a fear or a dread. See, this was God's way of now evening the score and protecting the animals. Imagine a hunter calling little Bambi out of the woods, feeding him a few sugar cubes out of his hand, and then opening fire. That wouldn't be fair. If God hadn't put a hostility between the animals and the humans, it would have been an unfair advantage for the humans, now hungry for meat. Well, God continues this covenant, verse 5. Surely, for your lifeblood, I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast, I will require it, and from the hand of man. In other words, if a pit bull mauls a young child, the dog needs to be put down. If he takes a life, the dog's life needs to be taken. But capital punishment also applies to man. For from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. Now notice, God's rationale for capital punishment is not deterrence. That was never the issue. Even though it does deter the criminal who dies, it does deter him. But it wasn't deterrence, that was not the issue. God prescribed capital punishment because humans were made in his image. And thus, to murder my fellow man is to literally attack God, to attack God's image. And that, friends, is deserving of death. The institution of capital punishment was, in essence, God's establishment of human government, his arm to defend and protect human life. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus told his followers to turn the other cheek, but he was speaking in terms of personal relationships. Jesus' instructions to individual Christians never changed the responsibility that God places on government. In verse 7, God instructs Noah and his descendants to reproduce. He says, "And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it." And then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, "And as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." And I recall that promise whenever we're encountered with several weeks of unrelenting rain. I remember it will all pass. There can be local flooding, certainly, but there will never be another global deluge. Here are a few more lessons that we learned from Noah. Don't miss the boat. Don't forget we're all in the same boat. Plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Stay in shape. When you're 600 years old, you might get assigned a really big job. Don't listen to your critics. Just get on with what has to be done. Good advice. Build your future on high ground. For safety's sake, travel in pairs. Speed isn't always an advantage. The snails were on board with the cheetahs. When you're stressed, float a while. The ark was built by amateurs. The Titanic was built by professionals. Think about that. The woodpeckers inside are a greater threat than the storm outside. Probably so. And no matter the storm, when God is with you, there's a rainbow waiting. And we find that rainbow in verse 12. "And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth." God hangs up his bow in the clouds. Of course, the rainbow is an optical phenomenon where droplets of water refract the light and they create a prism effect. Water reveals the colors of the spectrum. There were probably rainbows before the flood, perhaps in the mist that watered the Garden of Eden. You could see a little rainbow. But since the flood was the first time that it had actually rained, no human prior to Noah had ever seen a rainbow hanging in the clouds. The Hebrew term translated rainbow refers to the bow and arrow, the weapon, the bow. And so when God hung up his rainbow in the sky, it was as if he were hanging up his bow of judgment. The flood was now over. It would never be repeated. Whenever Noah heard a clap of thunder, whenever Noah now saw a bolt of lightning piercing the sky, he would look up and he would see God's bow in the clouds. And notice it was pointed upwards, not downward. It reminded Noah and all men that God's judgment had ceased. It had now passed. The rainbow was a reminder for all humanity that God's agenda from now on in this age until the end of the age is salvation, not condemnation. Remember that. God is for you, not against you. Verse 17, and God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Verse 18 lists your great, great, great grandpa. For every human being has descended from Noah and his wife. And if they had no kids, no additional kids, then we also all come from either Shem, Ham, or Japheth. A 2009 Washington Post article titled, Among Many Peoples, Little Genomic Variety. It discusses how today's scientists believe all human populations now fall into just three genetic groupings: Africans, Eurasians, and East Asians. Since Noah had just three sons, that makes sense, doesn't it? Also, in April 2015, the Journal of Creation printed an article by Carter and Hardy that takes current population trends and extrapolates them backwards 4,500 years. Amazingly, they ended up with a total world population of 8, the exact number that exited the ark. Well, the last 10 verses of chapter 9 of Genesis tell a sad story. See, Noah was a man of faith and obedience. We've come to admire Noah. But after walking with God for 600 years, can you imagine? One night, he drops his guard. And sadly, one event can mar an otherwise stellar life. Noah figures a little wine won't hurt him. But instead of a glass, Noah gets drunk. Noah takes a drink. The drink takes a drink. And then the drink takes Noah. Here is the first mention of wine or alcohol in the Bible, and it leads a person to nudity and sin. Not a good first impression for wine. Verse 20 tells us, and Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. Then he drank of the wine and was drunk, and he became uncovered in his tent. And boy, this still happens. Alcohol and nakedness have a connection. Alcohol topples our inhibitions. It breaks down our modesty. Did you know this is why 75% of sexual assaults on campus involve alcohol? It gets Noah in trouble too. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and went backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away, and they did not see their father's nakedness. And that's how you should handle this situation. So Noah awoke from his wine, and he knew what his younger son had done to him. Now, at the very least, Ham was guilty of disrespect. He had mocked and insulted his drunk dad. But there are scholars who believe that Ham was guilty of a sin far more sinister. Notice, Noah wakes up and he knows what his son did to him. Not just what he said about him. The implication is that Ham performed a physical act. Some scholars say he molested Noah, sodomized his own dad. The Jewish Talmud records that Ham castrated Noah. Of course, all this is speculation, but Ham definitely kicked his dad when he was down. Shouldn't do that. Whatever the crime, here is Noah's sentence. Then he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants, he shall be to his brethren." Interestingly, Ham's son is cursed, not Ham. And we really don't know why. It's probable that Canaan somehow participated in the act with Ham. Thus, he gets the punishment. His role may have been worse than Ham's. Ham's curse, though, will be fulfilled in the future of his son. He'll be a servant to his brethren. The Canaanites will eventually become slaves. When Joshua leads the children of Shem, or the Hebrews, into Canaan, he subdues its residents, which are the Canaanites. The family of Canaan becomes servants to the Hebrews. One thing is certain, any attempt here by white racists to apply the curse of Ham to black Africans and to justify slavery is a terrible misuse of Scripture. Some of Ham's descendants did settle in Africa, but the curse was on one son, Canaan, not on the rest of Ham's family, not on all his descendants. And notice here, his son Canaan, he didn't even have black skin. This is a preposterous idea that people put together to support racism. Noah also said in verse 26, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem." Shem will be the father of the Hebrews, of Abraham and the Jews. "And may Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem." One day the Gentiles, Japheth's family, will seek refuge in the blessings of Israel. "And may Canaan be his servant." And Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Chapter 10. Now this is the genealogy of the sons of Noah: Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And sons were born to them after the flood. And what comes next we call the Table of Nations. And there is really nothing else in antiquity like it. There's no parallel. This is the clearest cultural roadmap of the ancient world. It shows the distribution of Noah's descendants throughout the post-flood earth. The sons of Japheth were Gomer, that is, the Germanic peoples, Magog, or Russia, Madai, which was what has become today the Kurds, Javan, or Greece, Tubal, Meshech, perhaps Moscow, and Tyrus, or the Italians. The sons of Gomer were Ashkenaz. I'm not going to go through all of these. Riphath and Togomar. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kedim, Dodanim. From these, the coastland peoples of the Gentiles were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. Chapter 10 is now charting the migration that's going to occur after the events of chapter 11. We'll get to chapter 11 next week. And the sons of Ham were Cush, or Ethiopia, Mizraim, Egypt, Put, which was a part of ancient Egypt, which is today Somalia, and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Sheba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, and Sabtaka, maybe. And the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. These were Arabian tribes on the Arabian Peninsula. Verse 8 is a parenthesis in Ham's genealogy, an important one. Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. The name Nimrod means to rebel. And that is exactly what this man did. After the flood, God hung up his bow for all to see. God wanted to make peace with mankind. But Nimrod became the mighty hunter before the Lord. One interpretation puts it, the mighty hunter against the Lord. The idea was that Nimrod was hunting people to draw them away from God and after himself. No doubt Nimrod was a skilled hunter of animals. And think of the prestige that this would give him in the post-flood world, where humans and animals had just gone from pals to now predators. Noah had spent a year with the lions and tigers inside the ark. But now, every time the bushes rustle, it sends a scare through Noah's descendants. Man's former furry friends could be stalking him for dinner. He doesn't know. And a mighty hunter would become a hero, a protector of mankind. He could make very appealing promises. He could paint himself as a savior. Tradition tells us that Nimrod was also the first human to domesticate horses and to bring the animal kingdom under man's dominion. Folks saw Nimrod as a savior. And in Genesis 11, this man will become the world's first antichrist. He'll offer a false and phony salvation. Back to the nations. From that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Calah, and Resen, between Nineveh and Calah, that is the principal city. Mizraim begat Ludim, Ananim, Lehabim, Naphtahim, Pathrusim, and Kalslushim, from whom became the Philistines and Kaphtorim, or the Egyptians. Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Mosquitobite, and the Uptite, and the Outisite. Afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed, and the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon on the Lebanese coast, as you go toward Gerar, which is southward, as far as Gaza, you know where that is, if you've been watching current events. Then you go toward Sodom, east to the Dead Sea, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zoboim, as far as Lasha. These were the sons of Ham, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, and in their nations. This would be land later given by God to Israel. Verse 21, and children were born also to Shem, the father of all the children of Eber, probably short for the word Hebrews, the brother of Japheth the elder. The sons of Shem, and this becomes now the lineage of Messiah, were Elam, Ashur, Aphaxad, Lud, and Aram. The sons of Aram were Uz. Guess who was from the land of Uz? Do you remember? Job was from the land of Uz. Hul, Gether, and Mash. It was a Mash unit. Aphaxad begot Selah, and Selah begot Eber. And this is interesting. To Eber was born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, which means division. For in his days, the earth was divided. What in the world does that mean? Well, today, geologists talk about a former supercontinent. They call it Pangaea. They believe the earth was once a single connected landmass that eventually, after the flood, broke apart into seven subcontinents. And just a quick look at a globe and the shape of the continents makes it pretty easy to imagine all seven continents fitting together like puzzle pieces into one landmass. Apparently, in the aftermath of the flood, the earth broke apart and drifted on the oceans. This is how the kangaroos made it from Ararat to Australia, and how the Indians reached the New World. People and animals traveled across huge land bridges that existed up until the days of division, or the days of Peleg. Well, Peleg's brothers name was Joktan. And Joktan begot Almadad, Sheleph, Hazamapheth, Jera, Hodoram. I practiced these ahead of time and I did much better. Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Abimael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. His buddies shortened that. They just called him Job. He was the man who learned that God is worthy to be praised even when he doesn't always answer our whys. All these were the sons of Joktan, and their dwelling place was from Mesha as you go toward Sephar, the mountain of the east. These were the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, in their lands, according to their nations. These were the families of the sons of Noah, according to their generations, in their nations, and from these the nations were divided on the earth after the flood. And you would think that men after the flood would learn to honor God and to obey God. Not so. Chapter 11 displays mankind's spiritual bankruptcy. Chapter 11. It brings us the first worldwide coup d'etat, or an uprising against God's rule. And so next week, you need to read Genesis 11 through 14. A big transition takes place.